Gresham College presents, Do We Need a Martian Invasion in Order to Avoid Attacking Each Other? By Rodney Barker, Gresham Professor of Rhetoric.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome once again to Gresham College. Those of you who've been before will know not only what I'm about to say, but that I'm about to say it. At the end of the lecture, there will be a handout available, which is a sort of parallel text to what I'm going to be saying. Some of the things that I will say will not be on it, and some of the things that are on it I won't have got around to saying, but it will give you a rough idea of what's happened this evening. I hope you won't need a rough idea at the end of this evening's hour, but if you do, there's something to remember it by. And, of course, the other thing is that I will leave time within the hour for questions, and there will be a handheld mic which will go around. I hope that this evening, before we get to the questions, I'll be able to take up some of the very interesting points that have been raised over the last six sessions by members of the audience. I always tell friends that the most interesting part of this session is the questions. And I hope some of the questions which have been raised over the last 6 months, I will possibly, well, I'm sure not solve, but at least have some interesting things to say about them during the course of this evening. I'm going to start with a picture. I hope I am. Yes, there it is. Some of you, of course, may know exactly what that is, but I certainly didn't until I found it. It's a Dennis fire engine, a 1930 Dennis fire engine. Now, that particular Dennis fire engine belongs to the Burton-on-Trent Fire Brigade. But it's not Burton-on-Trent I want to start with. It's 13 of those fire engines, the exact model, pretty much, which belong not in Burton-on-Trent, but in the Republic of Ireland. On the night of April the 15th, 1941, the Luftwaffe bombed Belfast, and bombed Belfast fairly severely. Well, of course, Belfast was in Northern Ireland, part of the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland. ERA, the Irish Free State, the Irish Republic, was, of course, a quite different country. And it was neutral. It was not part of the war. It had not declared war on Germany. Germany had not declared war on it. And so any attempt by Irish men and women in the Republic to assist their Irish brothers and sisters in Belfast, who had been bombed, would be a breach of neutrality. Would place Ireland in a quite different relationship to Germany. Nonetheless, on the night of April the 15th, the Irish Taoiseach, Eamon de Valera, responded to a plea for help from Northern Ireland and sent 13 fire engines, 13 Dennis fire engines, over the border to assist their fellow countrymen, as of course nationalists saw them anyway, in Belfast. In other words, the divisions between Northern Ireland and the rest of Ireland, the division between a Union-dominated North and a Republican South and West, were trumped by the presence of a common enemy in the face of the German Air Force. A common enemy can unite those who previously were at war, at odds with one another. And I've talked in previous lectures about the way in which enemies and the stories that people tell about enemies, true stories, exaggerated stories, entirely fictional stories, can have an effect of uniting. Enmity, the belief that out there there is some person or organization or group or nation or conspiracy which threatens all of us, can often lead to unity where there was previously division, and can often be used to enhance a sense of common identity where previously there was no such sense of common identity. And the theorists of enmity, who I was speaking about in my last lecture, have always pointed to the advantages, to these advantages. Enemies are useful. Division is useful, they argue, because it unites, because it creates a sense of common identity. Well, here's another instance of exactly that. Bit fuzzy, I'm afraid. And unlike the photograph of the Dennis fire engine, that, of course, is not real. That's a painting of the 300 Spartans holding back the might of the Persian Empire at Thermopylae in 480 BC. Well, that's the story. There were 300 Spartans there, but there were rather more of non-Spartans. And just round the corner, there was a very large army made up of the various city-states of Greece. The Spartans, the Athenians, and the various other small states of Greece were all united in the face of the common threat posed by the Persian invasion. And it wasn't really Thermopylae which was the crucial battle. It's the one which is the heroic battle. It's the one which even makes it into cinema on several occasions, when it's an occasion for people to dress up in very little and be very heroic with swords against overwhelming odds. But the crucial battles were later the same year. At Salamis, Persian naval power was destroyed by a Greek fleet, largely Athenian, but not entirely Athenian. And in the same year, again, at Plataea, the land might of the Persian army was destroyed by a united force of Greeks, Spartans, Athenians. A common enemy unites the separate city-states of 5th century BC Greece. That was in 480. 50 years later, in 431 BC, saw the beginning of the Peloponnesian War. The common enemy had been destroyed, and the Greek city-states were free to attack each other. Athens versus Sparta. It's almost as if they were anticipating the line of the much later Greek poet whom I quoted on a previous occasion: without the barbarians, we simply do not know what we will do. The Persians united Greece by attacking them. So not only can we find instances of a common enemy uniting those who otherwise would be attacking each other, but where states have no obvious enemies but are afraid of internal division within, civil discord, rebellion, unrest, they sometimes actively seek for stories to tell about enemies who might not actually be there. It's almost as if the common pitying phrase, "they're all alone without a friend in the world," is not the worst thing that can befall a state. The worst thing that can befall a state is to be all alone without an enemy in the world. But there are problems, disadvantages with that, or at least questions which one can raise against those who say what a useful thing enemies are. Because the unity which a state or a group of states can achieve is, of course, only achieved against others, real, whatever the stories told them about them, the people out there are real. Each depends on creating others as enemies and attacking them or being prepared to attack them. If we follow the example of the Athenians and the Spartans in the 5th century BC, the price of unity and solidarity within states or even between groups of states seems to be hostility between groups of states. Enemies unite societies, but they only do so by leading to conflict with other societies. And the objection, or the question, about the usefulness, the actual usefulness of enmity, about stories of about enemies, can be taken even further. Because an external enemy, or the belief in an external enemy, doesn't even necessarily guarantee internal cohesion, doesn't even necessarily guarantee unity within societies. Because however comprehensively the enemy is described, whether the enemy is real or imagined, there will always be those within the friend society who seem to have more in common with the enemy than with their fellow citizens, and who can therefore be labelled as traitors or suspects whose loyalties, it is said, lie elsewhere. And of course, the more fiercely, the more colourfully one's own society is described by contrast with the enemy, the more likely it is that there will be those who don't fit the particular pigeonhole. If, for instance, you say, well, who are the British people? Well, the British people are just people who live in the United Kingdom and observe the law. Well, that's pretty comprehensive. Everybody can fit that. But if you say, well, the British people are people who live within the United Kingdom and observe the law and enjoy cricket and football, you're already narrowing it down quite a bit. And if you then say, are religiously observant and like roast beef, the more specific you get, the more people you leave out. The more you describe, the more you exclude. The more an enemy, by contrast with the story about who we are, leads to a colourful account of the nation, the more actually the nation potentially is divided. Telling stories about external enemies, in other words, may unite societies and may make their colourful account of their own social and national identity simpler, but frequently at the expense of minorities, because societies never are uniform. There are always differences, there are always varieties. And those minorities, those people who don't fit, may even actually be created by the stories which are told about them, the enemy, and us, the society. All kinds of people who actually differ from each other in all kinds of ways can actually be very readily lumped together in this kind of account. The black community, the Asian community, the Muslim community, all kinds of people who wouldn't recognise each other as having anything in common at all can be created as a social phenomenon in these kind of accounts. And of course, we've got plenty of instances of that kind of unity at the beginning of the 20th century, when attempts are made to unify societies, to give an account of what unites us all, by a contrast between who we are and who they are. The American sociologist Samuel Huntington, between 1993 and 1996, was talking about the future as consisting of a clash of civilizations, and he particularly saw those civilizations as religiously based, and more specifically, Christianity versus Islam. But this has proved to be not so much a scenario for division between societies, but just as much a scenario for divisions within societies. Religious extremism, ferocity, zeal, enthusiasm based on faith can be just as divisive within societies as it can be between them. In the 6th of December 1992, for instance, in Gujarat, the Babri Mosque in the city of Ayodhya was destroyed by a Hindu mob who alleged that it had been built on a Hindu sacred site. A religious building was torn down by a group of people who saw their identity as challenged, not by an alien invasion, but by people who were members of their state, but who they defined as different from them. 2005, in the Sangla Hills in Pakistan, three churches destroyed by an Islamic mob. A Catholic church, a Salvation Army hut, and the United Presbyterian Church, torn down in the same kind of identity strife. What happens in these circumstances when the enemy is described and we are described is that all kinds of differences are oversimplified. All kinds of distinctions are obliterated and ignored. The story is told, I'm afraid it's not true, well, it may be true in essence, but it's certainly not true in detail, of a bomb attack in Northern Ireland at the height of the Troubles. And a doctor is driving along, and he sees that something has happened. So he stops his car, picks up his bag, and rushes forward to help. He's immediately stopped by some group of local militia. He doesn't know who they are. They want to know who he is. Who are you? Well, let me through. I'm a doctor. Are you a Catholic or a Protestant? But I'm a doctor. What's that got to do with it? Yes, but are you a Catholic or a Protestant? But as it happens, I'm neither. I'm a Buddhist. Yes, but are you a Catholic Buddhist or a Protestant Buddhist? There is no third position. So, there are two reasons to deplore attempts to create internal peacefulness and internal unity by means of descriptions or conjuring up of external threats, enemies, them out there. The first is that it can lead to global disharmony. It can lead to societies and states attacking each other. And the second is that it can lead to internal repression and discrimination. Societies are not uniform. Now, of course, there is a final solution to that, which is the one that I indicated in the title of this lecture, a totally external enemy to all humanity. That is not President Bush's latest innovation in the Star Wars program, and it's not real. Don't go home and say Gresham College professor says flying saucers have landed at the White House. But Mars attacks, the threat from outer space, frequently in science fiction films, in science fiction stories, leads to unity of the whole human race. So when the Martians are on the way, people can all unite because there is a common enemy. However, unfortunately or fortunately, Mars is not attacking. Mars is not available as a common enemy to unite all of humanity. So are there threats to the whole human race which can in fact serve to unite humanity? Not just this state or that society, but the whole of humanity in some sort of common endeavour, which can bring out a sense of common human identity. Well, of course, a metaphysical version of the Martian threat is the devil. But the trouble is that when the devil has been invoked, the result has usually been simply to unite one part of society against another. Martians are not usually attributed with having human allies, but the devil is. So is there something, even so, which we can rescue from the idea of threat as providing a basis for human solidarity? Is it possible to have human solidarity, human cooperation, as a result of threat, but without the social divisions which most of the examples which we've seen lead to? Well, they'd have to be non-human threats for a start. They can't be other people. So what are the possibilities? Well, here's one. Whoops, not that one. That one. In London, in the 19th century, to begin with, the better off lived upwind of the worst off. Living in the West End was actually rather important because the prevailing winds went from west to east. And so if you lived in the West End, particularly if you lived in sort of well-drained, hilly parts of North London, you didn't suffer from the contagion and the smell, which was there in the less well-located East End, or so people thought. But of course, cholera was a great democrat. Cholera did not distinguish between rich and poor. That's a cartoon of the Broad Street pump, which the Dr. John Snow in 1854 identified as the source, or the water from it, of cholera, which of course spread wherever. And one of the results of that was to lead to the provision of sewers, the wonderful Victorian sewers, which are only now being replaced, for the whole of London. Cholera was a common threat. Cholera did not distinguish between rich and poor, between respectable and feckless. Cholera affected everybody. And so it led to a common response. And in much the same way, that's the famous picture of St. Paul's during the Blitz, which the government allegedly suppressed at the time, because although on one hand it looks pretty sort of heroic, there is St. Paul's, as it were, ignoring the destruction. The other side of it, of course, is the destruction. So it was a slightly ambivalent picture. But the experience of total war from 1939 had a similar effect to the experience of cholera. All were affected. And although bombing actually by most sides, tended to be more most devastating in the most populated areas, the East End, which got it in the neck, which is why the king allegedly, George VI, when a bomb did eventually fall on Buckingham Palace, said, now we can look the East End in the face. Even so, bombs do not discriminate, and war does not discriminate. The energies of the whole population were needed in the war effort. The health of a factory worker was just as important as the health of a frontline soldier. And so hospital provision was made available and freely available. When it had not been for philanthropic reasons, it was in the face of a common threat. And of course, there is a common threat now. Just like the Broad Street pump or the war, global warming affects everybody. It doesn't just affect cars. But at this point, the effectiveness of common threats becomes a bit more questionable. Threats to nations, to whole populations, do seem to have the capacity to unite. Threats to the whole world don't necessarily work in the same way. That branch of social science which calls itself rational choice, and that branch which calls itself games theory, has a little example which they call the tragedy of the commons, which illustrates the point rather nicely. They imagine a situation where there is common land on which all the people around it can graze their cattle. Unfortunately, the grass is being exhausted. Too many cattle, too little grass. And if everybody carries on grazing their cattle, the grass will be destroyed and everybody will suffer. What does the rational person with his or her cluster of cows do? Well, according to this imaginary example, the tragedy of the commons, they reason in this way. If everybody keeps their cows on the common, then we're all going to perish, so I might as well get my bit of grazing. So I'll keep my cows on the common. However, if everybody is public-spirited except me, I still keep my cows on the common. The grass is saved and I'm all right. And of course, if everybody thinks like that, which is apparently the rational thing to do, the commons are destroyed. There is, I think, something of that, of the tragedy of the commons, in the reactions which we can see to global warming. Why should we suffer? You first. Nations such as China, which are rather late to make their contribution to global devastation, can reasonably argue that they have the right to do their little bit of destroying the environment in order to catch up. The West, the industrial relations, have had their turn. Now it's ours. There is also the problem that with global warming, it's the poorest, the least powerful, who suffer most. The people who most need united action to deal with that are the people who are least in a position to do something about it. So threats don't really seem to be the answer. And this is where I come on to some of the points that have been raised from the audience in previous lectures. Is there a different way of doing things? Is there a different way of creating a sense of identity within a society, creating a sense of common purpose, cooperation, unity. Is there, in other words, a positive rather than a negative way of getting the sort of results which we can't get from the Martian invasion? Well, one response is to say that what we need is global politics, global democracy, global government. How would that come about? Well, some people have said the spread of democracy is going to lead to a world where, in the end, people don't attack one another. Another American academic, Spencer Wirt, in a book published nearly 10 years ago now called Never at War, argued that democracies never attack one another. So, if you get enough democracies, there's nobody left to attack anybody, so we're fine. That was certainly something of the thinking which lay behind the formation of the League of Nations after the First World War. And non-democracies were not always admitted, which might be thought as one of the reasons why the League of Nations didn't succeed in averting the Second World War. It was also, of course, the thinking behind the formation of the United Nations at the end of the Second World War. The problem is that all of those sort of solutions depend on a degree of agreement, consent, argument for them to work, and yet that is precisely what they're set up to achieve. It's as if the chicken and the egg has been reversed. Precisely the kind of good results which international cooperation is intended to create can only work if it's already there. And the objection, of course, to the idea of global democracy is that democracy requires some kind of demos. Democracy is the political action of a free people. But you've got to have the free people in the first place for it to work. So is there perhaps another way of doing it? What about markets as an alternative to war? That's something that certainly has been raised from the floor on previous occasions. There have always been those who thought that actually markets certainly were possibly an alternative to hostility and provided the basis for peaceful collaboration amongst people. It was Dr. Johnson who said that a man is seldom more innocently occupied than when he is engaged in making money. If only people would just get on with making money, then we would all be a lot happier. Norman Angell, writing in this country before the First World War, had a rather similar view. Precisely because international trade was increasing, the commercial links between the countries of the world were becoming more and more entangled, it would not be in anybody's interests to engage in war, because peace was a necessary condition for trade and well-being. Well, it clearly was not a sufficient condition, because Angell's arguments were, as it were, trumped, wiped out by the destruction of 1914-18. A more recent example of Angell's argument might be to say, well, in a world where increasingly the nations are dependent on oil, it's obviously in the interests of all nations, particularly those who depend heavily on oil, to ensure peaceful collaboration between nations and certainly peaceful collaboration with the countries which produce oil. But it doesn't work because the United States, which depends heavily on oil, engineers a coup in Venezuela and invades Iraq. In other words, the need for commercial links apparently doesn't work in the way that it's supposed to. But the optimism continues. We've had now two occasions when there have been those who say that the age of violent antagonistic politics is over. The end of ideology is finished. The end of ideology has arrived. Ideology is finished. It was proclaimed in the 1950s, and of course it was proclaimed again at the end of the Cold War in 1989. The American writer Francis Fukuyama said, we have now arrived at the end of history. Now we're going to have democratic market politics. And democracy and markets are sensible ways of doing things, and we'll have no more No more conflict. And that sort of optimism continues. Thomas Friedman has promulgated the rather charming Golden Arches theory. The Golden Arches referred to are the Golden Arches of McDonald's burgers. This is a new commercial version of the argument that democracies don't attack one another. Friedman argues that no two countries, each of which have McDonald's burgers, will attack one another. The cynic might say, because the presence of a McDonald's burgers renders their armies incapable of fighting. I'm sceptical of this argument. So markets don't quite seem to do it either. So that's the second one. What about a third possibility? Is there continual enmity, both within societies and between them, simply because we've got the wrong people in charge? That was precisely what Virginia Woolf argued in 1938 in her essay Three Guineas. The problem was men and male aggression and male vanity. It led to precisely the sort of strutting on the international stage, which led to war, which led to conflict. It was the view which has been more recently expressed in those feminists who faced with cruise missiles and so on, say, take the toys from the boys. They are not grown up enough to play with these dangerous things. Well, maybe it would work, but the boys at the moment still have got their toys, and the degree of social transformation involved there, whether it would be successful or not, is still as far away from where we are now as either peaceful markets or global democracy. There's one more possibility, and that's natural solidarity, natural collaboration between people. The 19th century liberal theorist Herbert Spencer, a great believer in markets, always delights me that if you go to Highgate West Cemetery, not the spooky one, but the one which is open, you can see there the grave of Karl Marx. And there he is looking, I mean, this massive, fierce head. He looks like a rather sort of irate but very learned gorilla. And he's glowering across the path. You follow his eyes, and I like to think that the reason he's looking so fierce is that on the other side of the path is the stone slab, much less impressive, but very sort of utilitarian and puritanical, marking the grave of Herbert Spencer, the 19th century champion of markets. And there they are forever, Marx, Spencer, glowering at each other in Highgate Cemetery. But Spencer is interesting on this because he says that the progress of history is from command and control, the kind of societies where unity is created by commands from above, which are imposed by force, military style command, from that to voluntary cooperation. The movement of history is in the direction of societies cohering more and more by people simply collaborating with each other, so that government will become less and less necessary. It is, of course, the old liberal dream that government is best which governs least. It's the liberal dream which the American comedian Stephen Colbert was able to turn against George W. Bush at a speech in George W. Bush's presence when he said, "The president and I both believe that government is best which governs least. That's why US policy in Iraq is such a stunning success." Spencer certainly believed this, that government could eventually be replaced by cooperation. A rather different political thinker at the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th, the Russian anarchist Peter Kropotkin, believed something similar. Taking evolutionary theory, struggles for survival, he turned it in a rather interesting direction. Who is it that is successful in the struggle for survival, he argued? It's not individuals, it's species. And the species that are successful because they collaborate. Mutual aid. Cooperation, mutual aid, assistance is what is successful in the struggle for survival. So, again, history appears to be on the side of cooperation. It was both rational and successful in evolutionary terms. And a more recent example of some such argument is to be found in the, I still find very interesting, though now 30, nearly 40 years old, arguments about the provision of blood by the British social scientist Richard Titmuss. In a book called The Gift Relationship, he looked at the arguments, which were then becoming quite fashionable from the sort of the market right, about the value of markets in providing good things, and specifically providing blood for medical purposes. Titmuss argued that far from being efficient, the commercial provision of blood had two damaging consequences. One was that it undermined the solidarity of society. Because if you had a situation where people gave blood, and not only gave it to people they knew, but to people they did not know, but whom they regarded as common members of humanity, this was a desirable function, a desirable feature of society. It created good citizenship, mutual aid, but also that it was actually inefficient. Because if you sold blood, if you bought blood, you were buying blood from the people who had the greatest incentive to sell it. And who were they? They were the poor. They were the drug dependent. They were the criminals. You were likely to build into the provision of blood an incentive to provide bad blood. And certainly some of the scandals in blood provision many years after do suggest that Titmuss had a very important point there. So three rather different people here, a 19th century liberal, a late 19th and early 20th century anarchist, and a British social scientist, all arguing in their different ways that there is a strand in human society which not only seems to be moving in the direction of non-enmity-fueled collaboration, but a strand which means that this is effective, it's successful, more successful than the alternatives. And that, of course, in a way, takes us back to somebody I've spoken of on a different occasion who is very different from all three of these, which is the early 19th century German philosopher Hegel, who argued that people only fulfilled their identity truly in collective involvement with others. Not in conflict, but in collaborative enterprise. Now, if any of those provide a possible way forward without enmity, it still doesn't entirely answer the question. Because it's a bit like another apocryphal Irish story. The man who is lost somewhere in the wilds of Ireland stops a passerby and says, "How do I get to Dublin?" To which, of course, the answer is, "Well, if I were you, I wouldn't start from here." We are a long way from any of these places. But here is where we are. And so what are the possibilities? Well, the problem with each of those four possibilities that I mentioned, markets, global politics, natural collaboration, the wrong people in charge, is that none of them provide easy mechanisms for getting there, and none of them seem to provide, even in the most benign way, some kind of incentive for people to combine together. It doesn't have to be an enemy, but at least a threat. But even so, perhaps we can create unity, common identity, without anyone to blame, without anyone to fear, without anybody to oppose, without at the same time clamping down some single image of what it is to be a member of a society or of the human race. Because if not, Anybody who wants seriously to cultivate solidarity amongst all the peoples will, in fact, have to convince us that there is a Martian invasion on the way after all. I'm going to stop there and leave time for questions. There will be a microphone going round. There's a gentleman here.
Yeah, I remember well the incident of De Valera sending the fire engines to Belfast.
Yes.
I would just like to suggest that there may have been an added incentive there. Mr. De Valera was strongly devoted to the idea of a united Ireland.
Yes, yes.
And there may have been a certain strategic reason.
Yes.
In order to yes. make the Unionists of the North more ameliorative.
Yes.
I remember too the at least report to me as a youngster of I think 7 or 8 of what Lord Haw was supposed to have said on one of his broadcasts yes. shortly after that.
Yes.
He said, Mr. De Valera, if you're not careful, you might have fires of your own to put out. Yes. But I think if you're going to use or try to deal with the enemies within your own society, they've surely got to be enemies, groups that have been well defined as enemies before that. You couldn't just start create new enemies in order to create that solidarity against an outside invader. Now, there's another thing occurs to me there. Supposing you had a Martian invasion was a realistic possibility, yes. and you had, say, 3 superpowers,
yes.
one out on its own.
Yes.
A considerable margin between it and the second power.
Yes.
And a similar margin between the second and the third.
Yes.
Would there not be a temptation there for the second or third greatest power to join up with the invaders?
Yes, there are several points there, starting with De Valera. Lord Haw's threat was, I think, not a realistic threat in the sense that Germany was not going to declare war on the Republic of Ireland, but a nation which breaches its neutrality in the way that De Valera did, or risked doing, by sending the fire engines over the border in 1941, clearly risks that. And I'm sure you're right, yes, of course. I mean, one of the reasons that De Valera was happy or content to send the fire engines over the border is that this is a very, very public statement, I mean, a physical statement of the fact that we are all Irish men and women together. We have a common identity in the face of a common threat. So in that sense, yes, it was politically very astute. It made him look benign, heroic, standing by our fellow countrymen, but there was a threat involved. I don't have a problem with that. It seems to me that if you could imagine a situation where people acted in a good way, I'm not too worried about the motives why they do so. And I'd much rather have a situation where it's in people's interest to be good and collaborative than where they do it simply out of duty and they regard it as not in their interests. So, I don't mind what De Valera was up to, in a sense. On your other point, I doubt it, actually. Fortunately, we don't have to. It's very rare. It's very unwise to speculate in politics anyway. People are always saying, what's the result of the next election going to be, what's going to happen in Russia in the next 5 years? My sense is that anybody who tries answering those questions, like all those people who in 1988 said, "Soviet Union." 100 years, still going to be there. Margaret Thatcher, she's going to be there for longer than any other prime minister. Very, very dodgy. It's even more dodgy than putting your money on the horses, I think, making predictions in politics. But when it's the Martians, I think that on the whole, a sense of common identity is much more powerful often than a sense of what one might think of as sort of rational materialist interest. That, yes, you can imagine a leader or a nation saying, well, you know, it's possibly worth allying with these Martians or holding back so that the other lot can be wiped out. But I suspect sort of instinctive solidarity, these are our sort of people, those are not even people, you know, those are Martians in spaceships, would trump it. I think I'm never going to have to prove right or wrong on that one. But that's my guess. There's a lady here.
Two points. The first one is, I think actually I agree with this gentleman about the Martians, because, not that it's going to happen pretty soon, very soon, but because there isn't any unity in the world at the moment, if an extraterrestrial force did attack, we would never think, well, what should we do all together? Because we wouldn't be considering the people in Tierra del Fuego or Tasmania or at the other ends of the earth. We'd all be thinking of our own national or even personal interests, despite what science fiction films show us, that we just panic in the end anyway. And the people who are the most powerful in this case, probably the Americans and, I don't know, maybe the Chinese, would actually be calling the shots with the Martians, because they'd be the ones with all the power to vanquish the enemy. And they wouldn't, I don't think they'd really take into consideration everybody else in the world. And everyone else would just have to accept what the world leaders decided to do, that power would be in the hands of very few people. I think the second point is about social cohesion and collaboration. You said something about the survival of a species, and this happens when the individuals of the species collaborate. Well, it's obviously true with bees and ants and such like, but rats are supposed to be the great survivors, and they're going to be one of the few species who survive a nuclear war, for example, we were told. And I don't think they're particularly collaborative. And also, I mean, tortoises have been around for a really long time, and other lizards, and amoeba. I mean, I don't think it's necessarily collaboration which helps the survival of species. It would be nice to think so, but I don't think it's actually true.
I think, yes, I mean, we're clearly lining up for a whole new Gresham chair in Martian studies, where we've got to try and speculate on how the nations of the world would respond. I don't know. The thing about collaboration within species, I mean, what Kropotkin was arguing was, yes, I mean, it was the positive side of it. But I don't think you would find an example of a species which survived where its members actually attacked one another on a fairly consistent basis. Which is why, I mean, Kropotkin wasn't the only one who noticed this. Interestingly, H.G. Wells, who amongst other things was sort of an early social democrat in this country, one of his science fictions, one of the early ones, was precisely that the ants are about to take over the world. Because they collaborate, and they're so small and you can't really do anything about them. I think if you found a species which was marked by internal hostility, it would either be pretty sort of marginal, or wouldn't be there anymore to observe anyway, because it would have wiped itself out. I mean, I'm not an anthropologist, but anthropologists discovered this tribe in somewhere in Central Africa called, I think, the Eek, who were he knows about the Eek more than I do, I suspect. Yeah. They're not a hugely successful tribe because they're so unpleasant to one another that you know, they just about survive. But it's there's a gentleman here.
I think I have personally put my lot of confidence in advances in technology and medicine. I think, and I hope, that in not too distant the future, they would produce a more docile human being. Computers and advances in genetic engineering can provide the environment in which hostility and aggression and violence can be controlled. It is a new area. There's a lot of work in this area, identifying the appropriate genes and with the computing power that controls lots of decision-making, removing decision-making from human beings who can't do that. I think there is a great deal of hope. I have my confidence, maybe misplaced, but I think that future is quite nice. I don't mind becoming a moron in that environment.
Well, I wasn't going to make it a personal comment, but certainly there have been fantasies of pretty much the same sort of thing that you're describing. I suppose A Clockwork Orange, actually, the novel and the film, are rather like that, where people are peaceful but sort of lobotomized. I remember this wonderful film, an early Jane Fonda film, where she's talking about California, where everybody seems to be sort of peacefully floating around. She says, well, it's like paradise with a lobotomy. And lots of writers have envisaged something like that and objected to it. Aldous Huxley's Brave New World. You know, everybody is on some kind of drug and they're very peaceful, but there are no moral choices anymore. There's no excitement, there's no creativity. I don't know. I mean, there is a clear choice there. If one could imagine a future in which nobody really did anything very exciting, but nobody hurt anybody else, and people sort of pottered around, and I mean, it is a bit like the Orson Welles thing about Switzerland. 1,000 years of democracy, and what did they produce? The cuckoo clock, which is not actually true, but it's the sort of downside of that kind of vision. And there have always been those who, in that sense, are gamblers. They're moral gamblers. They say, yes, the sort of vision you provide there is peaceful. There's no conflict. Nobody harms one another. But the moral autonomy of humans has been taken away because they do good, but... Well, that's it. Yes, yes, yes. God, computer, whoever it is, controls everything. It depends. I think there's a real choice there. Yes. Gentleman at the back.
I think regarding the question of the tendency of people when attacked by the Martians or whoever... to club together or whatever. Mm. I think in some ways the inscrutability of the motives of the enemy has something to bear on that.
Yeah.
With regard to the two islands and
yeah.
You know, the motivation, whether yes. or not you can actually feel that you could trust the enemy.
I mean, yes.
In the case of the Martian attack, you know, one would imagine that you know any actual alien civilization would be so remote from our understanding that you know we would not be able to you know one would not feel that one could treat with that enemy in much the same way I suppose as the Greeks
yes.
United against the Spartans because yes. United against the Persians rather because they
yes.
were a completely alien civilization and alien to their entire way of thinking
yes.
and you know Europeans with yeah. the attack of the Huns and similar yeah. situations. Yeah.
Yes, I think in a way that's possibly an answer to the question from over here. You know, faced with a Martian invasion, even the most rabid loyalist or Republican is not going to say, well, you're an alien, but are you a Catholic alien or a Protestant alien? There is another and deeper division there. Yes, yes, I'm sure. Yes. There's a lady there.
I was just wondering if you yourself are optimistic about the possibility for greater human cooperation in the absence of an alien invasion, and if you are, whether you think which of your routes you think might be the most fertile.
Okay. Yeah, well, yes, I suppose I'm optimistic might be putting it too strongly, but it's clearly possible, and there clearly are instances It's something I've mentioned in an earlier lecture, of deeply divided societies, which without in any way being perfect, have reached a greater level of unity. And actually, I mean, we've spoken about Ireland quite a lot. Northern Ireland is precisely one, where as a result of an enormous amount of hard work and patience and putting up with people whom one regards as, you know, totally beyond the pale from all sides, and compromising and swallowing one's pride, a situation has been arrived at which is safer, less violent. You know, it's not utopia, but it's not nearly as bad as it was. And the other one is South Africa. I mean, partly, again, due to the same sort of thing. I mean, one or two truly, I think, remarkable people, like Nelson Mandela. And the way in which there was a degree of reconciliation, of tolerance, of putting aside old grievances. And that's not to say, which is clearly not the case, that either Northern Ireland or South Africa are utopias, but they are societies where, as a result of, I mean, hard-working politics, in a way, things have been made better. So there are examples where one can say, yes, it is possible, which is not the same as saying it's inevitable, and it's certainly not the same as saying, fine, we can sit back and let the currents of history take us there. But it's possible. Yeah, yeah, yeah. We've sort of passed the hour, but could two very, very swift questions, if people are prepared to make them very swift. One there and this gentleman here. And perhaps then I can respond to them both very swiftly together.
I take the Christian view that he says that there's always going to be wars and rumours of wars. And I think the problem is not out there. I think it's coming from the heart. Mm. Greed, pride, and all those different things. Mm. So we can see things which need to be done, but those things, as soon as they affect us, we'll forget about them.
Yes, yes. Can we pass it over? Pass it round? Or I can... Now, there's an instance of collaboration.
Is it possible to collaborate in a competitive situation for survival among people?
Is it possible to collaborate for survival? Yes. And it's probably a more effective way of surviving. I'm very interested by all this stuff now. You get your survival courses teaching you how to, eat mice and make fires out of heather and so on if you're alone on the moor. But actually, if there are 10 of you, you're much more likely to survive if you collaborate. So.
Situation where, I want to have this and you, regardless of you.
Yes. Yes, but I. Collaboration in crisis situations, I mean, one can find examples of both, which is why I can answer the lady's question at the back, optimistic but not deterministic. You can find instances of where people in a crisis situation scrabble with each other, and in fact none of them survive, or you can find circumstances where, or maybe one does, but you can find instances where actually it is collaboration. It's everybody taking an oar in the lifeboat, which means you get to dry land. So it's choice. People can choose, which of course is why I'm sceptical about the I was going to say the drug-filled utopia. That's a slightly unkind, but you know what I mean. We should stop. Yeah.
For all information, please go to our website at www.gresham.ac.uk.